This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents What Happened to Bernie Sanders by Jared H. Beck, Esquire. Performed by Peter Burkrot. Dedicated to the memory of my grandfather, Henry Lessig, who proudly defended his country in World War II and bore testimony to his grandchildren about the horrible suffering endured by the Japanese people on the night of the Black Snow. Foreword by David Talbot. The world is burning, and yet the firelight illuminates the way out. The times are dire, even catastrophic. Nonetheless, we can sense a grand awakening, a growing realization all around the globe that people have the power to dream, to rule, to wrestle the world from fools, in the prophetic words of Patti Smith. But in order to rouse ourselves from the nightmares that hold us in their grip, we need to know more about the forces that bedevil us, the structures of power that profit from humanity's exploitation, and from that of the earth. That's the impetus behind Hot Books, a series that seeks to expose the dark operations of power and to light the way forward. Skyhorse publisher Tony Lyons and I started Hot Books in 2015 because we believe that books can make a difference. Since then, the Hot Books series has shined a light on the cruel reign of racism and police violence in Baltimore. Dee Watkins, The Beast Side. The poisoning of U.S. soldiers by their own environmentally reckless commanding officers. Joseph Hickman's The Burn Pits. The urgent need to hold U.S. officials accountable for their criminal actions during the War on Terror. Rachel Gordon's American Nuremberg. The covert manipulation of the media by intelligence agencies. Nicholas Skow's Spooked. The rise of a rape culture on campus. Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering's The Hunting Ground. The insidious demonizing of Muslims in the media and Washington. Arsalan Iftikhar's Scapegoats. The crackdown on whistleblowers who know the government's dirty secrets. Mark Hurstgard's Bravehearts. The disastrous policies of the liberal elite that led to the triumph of Trump. Chris Hedges' Unspeakable. The American wastelands that gave rise to this dark reign. Alexander Zaychik's The Gilded Rage. The energy titans and their political servants who are threatening human survival. Dick Russell's Horsemen of the Apocalypse. The utilization of authoritarian tactics by Donald Trump that threaten to erode American democracy. Brian Klass's The Despot's Apprentice. The capture, torture, and detention of the first high-value target captured by the CIA after 9/11. Joseph Hickman and John Kiriakou's The Convenient Terrorist. And the deportation of American veterans. J. Malcolm Garcia's Without a Country. And the series continues, going where few publishers dare. Hot Books are more condensed than standard-length books. They're packed with provocative information and points of view that mainstream publishers usually shy from. Hot Books are meant not just to stir readers' thinking, but to stir trouble. Hot Books authors follow the blazing path of such legendary muckrakers and troublemakers as Upton Sinclair, Lincoln Steffens, Rachel Carson, Jane Jacobs, Jessica Mitford, I.F. Stone, and Seymour Hersh. The magazines and newspapers that once provided a forum for this deep and dangerous journalism have shrunk in number and available resources. Hot Books aims to fill this crucial gap. American journalism has become increasingly digitized and commodified. If the news isn't fake, it's usually shallow. But there's a growing hunger for information that is both credible and undiluted by corporate filters. A publishing series with this intensity cannot keep burning in a vacuum. Hot Books needs a culture of equally passionate readers. Please, spread the word about these titles. Encourage your bookstores to carry them, Post comments about them in online stores and forums. Persuade your book clubs, schools, political groups, and community organizations to read them and invite the authors to speak. It's time to go beyond packaged news and propaganda. It's time for hot books. Journalism without borders. Preface. This is the story of why Bernie Sanders lost the 2016 Democratic primaries. It is also the story of a class action lawsuit brought by donors to Sanders' campaign, who sued the Democratic National Committee, the DNC, and its former chairperson, Congresswoman Deborah Wasserman Schultz, for rigging the primary process in favor of Hillary Clinton. I am the attorney for the plaintiffs in this case, which is currently on appeal with the 11th Circuit Court of Federal Appeals after being dismissed by the District Court. Because the case was dismissed on preliminary grounds and well before proceeding to the merits, and because appellate courts rarely reverse cases, it is unlikely that my client's claims will ever be tried before a jury. However, this reality does not mean the evidence, much of which is already a matter of public record, cannot be assembled, described, and set before the public in a cohesive manner. This, after all, is one of the main purposes of the legal trial: to arrive at the truth through rigorous assessment of the evidence. The issues presented by the rigging of the 2016 primaries surely deserve, if not demand, a public hearing. And not all public hearings happen in a courtroom. So, I have set upon this book with that goal in mind, recognizing, of course, that there are some inherent limitations. For example, only evidence that has been made public record can be cited, as our case was dismissed before the discovery process even got off the ground. And of course, I cannot present live witness testimony, which is the heart of any trial. In addition, the defendants will not have an opportunity to respond or present their own evidence. That said, I have tried to structure this book as I might a courtroom presentation, starting with an opening statement that charts the history of the lawsuit. Acts 1 and 2 present the evidence. This evidence shows, in my mind, irrefutably, but I will let the reader be the judge, that Bernie Sanders was destined to lose the race for the 2016 Democratic Party nomination even before he entered the race, because the DNC and its allies rigged the process for another candidate. These chapters move from close analysis of internal DNC documents, published by WikiLeaks and others, demonstrating how the very organization that was obligated, by its own charter, with running the elections in a fair and even-handed manner, did everything it could to ensure that Hillary Clinton would be the nominee. I examine the financial ties between Clinton's campaign and the DNC that rendered the latter nothing more than an arm of the former. I also pay close attention to the media landscape and how Sanders' candidacy was deliberately undermined by false narratives created in the mainstream corporate media by Clinton loyalists, as well as the superdelegate system, which has evolved over time to bar genuine progressive candidates, another McGovern, such as Sanders, from ever attaining the nomination. In a summation or closing statement, it is up to the attorney to recount all the important evidence that has been presented during the trial, address weaknesses or holes suggested by the other side, and, in the end, plead with the jury to return the verdict that he or she wants from the client. In my summation, I am less concerned about asking for a legal judgment, something which can only be delivered by a court of law, and more focused on situating the questions of what happened to Bernie Sanders, and what we have learned from trying to prosecute election rigging claims within the present-day American legal system, against the larger issues of how to think about the American political system. Does the term democracy even describe or relate to our political system in any meaningful sense? And if we are not a democracy, what kind of political system do we have, and what are the consequences? I firmly believe that these questions, in one form or another, are the most significant political issues presently before the American people, who will eventually have to return some manner of verdict. I believe understanding the plight of Sanders and his supporters is key to comprehending the current American political landscape, along with the various, often conflicting forces swirling around it. Indeed, the presidential election of 2016 is unique, in the sense it is still being fought by the parties, even after we pass the one-year anniversary of Donald Trump's inauguration. While the 2000 election was the first to be litigated within the judicial system between the major party candidates following Election Day, the Supreme Court handed down Bush v. Gore, effectively deciding the election for George W. Bush, over 1 month before Inauguration Day. Further back in history, the notoriously controversial election of 1876 was settled by the Compromise of 1877, just days before Rutherford B. Hayes took office. In contrast, while the presidential torch has formally been passed to Trump, as the Electoral College winner is certified in a joint session of Congress on January 6, 2017, a battle over the legitimacy of his election, and indeed his qualification to serve as president, continues to rage. The notion that Russia colluded with the Trump campaign to skew the election to Trump has become a prevailing mainstream media narrative and a mainstay talking point of the Democratic Party. Numerous Democrats have loudly called for Trump's impeachment, and articles of impeachment have been introduced in Congress. Meanwhile, Trump's Democratic opponent, Hillary Clinton, has publicly declared herself to be the real winner of the election, squarely pinning the result on Russian interference and an opponent who broke all the rules. The battle is not just rhetorical in nature. A special counsel has been appointed to investigate the allegations of collusion between Trump's campaign and Russia, and two separate grand juries, in Virginia and the District of Columbia, are now conducting criminal investigations. On October 30, 2017, the first three indictments were announced by special counsel Robert S. Mueller III, with more expected. 1 month later, Trump's former national security adviser, Michael T. Flynn, pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI during its investigation into alleged collusion with Russia. The question of whether Trump's election was aided and abetted by Russia is beyond the scope of this book. As a lawyer, I have full confidence that the truth will ultimately emerge through the ongoing legal proceedings, and if not there, in the court of public opinion. In fact, both sides of the case have already been presented to the public in some detail. Instead, I would suggest that the key to understanding what happened in a general election that has sparked an ongoing public debate about the legitimacy of the election itself is to first undertake an examination of the 2016 Democratic primaries, where forces menacing American political life operated more transparently. An honest assessment of these primaries, free from the hotly tinged rhetoric of Russian interference and threats to national security, shows that Bernie Sanders lost to Hillary Clinton because he never had a chance to win. In multiple ways, the process was rigged, and rigged for Clinton. These pages will document how a web of forces, emanating from elite interests through the mainstream media and Democratic political establishment, and fronted by the Democratic National Committee, operated to ensure that Clinton would secure the nomination. As such, not only did Clinton carry an overwhelming material advantage in funding and support from the political establishment into the primaries, but the contest occurred within a system that itself was structured to ensure her victory. In other words, the story of the 2016 Democratic primaries is the story of how corruption has critically eroded America's political institutions to the point of crippling democracy itself. The assessment of what happened to Bernie Sanders, whose campaign inspired hope for so many through visions of a political revolution without recent precedent in U.S. political history, appears dark and foreboding. If there is any beacon of light, it is that the truth can no longer be fully hidden. Indeed, the truth already began to emerge in the summer of 2016, even before the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, with the publication by purported hacker, Guccifer 2.0, and online publisher WikiLeaks, of internal DNC documents supplying direct evidence of collusion by and among actors in the DNC, the Clinton campaign, and mainstream media to elevate her to the nomination. Those documents have afforded Americans an extraordinary, behind-the-curtain view of how their political system actually functions. Although the forces that prevented Bernie Sanders from winning are systemic in nature, they can no longer operate under cover of darkness. The Internet age, and with it, the development of revolutionary publishers like WikiLeaks and new channels of dissemination embedded in social media, have brought a dawning of some transparency to bear on the workings of government. Every day, Americans gain consciousness regarding the true form of their governing institutions. If there is any glimmer of hope, it is that such consciousness is the very precondition for Americans to free themselves from those forces which have seized control of their political life and pushed it in an increasingly undemocratic direction. Opening statement. Democracy demands the truth. In 2016, the dream was shared by over 12 million Democratic primary voters, as well as nearly 2.5 million campaign donors, that for the first time in 44 years, a genuinely progressive candidate might run for President of the United States as a major party candidate. These supporters of Bernie Sanders' historic candidacy genuinely believed in his vision of a political revolution, whereby the United States would reverse its drift toward oligarchy while creating a government which represents all the people and not just a few. This is about the death of that dream, or, more precisely, why the considerable faith, effort, and resources of so many Americans put into Sanders' campaign was based on a false hope. In the end, Sanders lost the contest for the Democratic nomination because the Democratic Party, through its governing body, the Democratic National Committee, had determined that Hillary Clinton would be the nominee even before Sanders announced his candidacy. From the beginning, the fix was in, so to speak, and not in a loose sense signifying the obvious outsized advantage in campaign funding and political connections that Clinton brought to the table. Rather, Sanders' candidacy proceeded within a primary electoral system that was designed and shaped with the specific purpose of excluding candidates in the mold of George McGovern, who unsuccessfully contended as the Democratic candidate for president in 1972, from ever acceding to the party's nomination again. Given the unprecedented ability to peer behind the scenes of the U.S. political process through the works of revolutionary media sources, most notably WikiLeaks, the contours of this electoral system, along with its inherent biases, can be diagrammed and described with more precision than ever before in modern American political history. In seeking the explanation for how the dreams of millions of Americans came to be shattered in this manner, I have found it necessary to come to terms with the potential demise of my own dreamscape, one that has propelled my life path since my middle school days in a small suburban community outside of Albany, New York. I believe the setting for this dreamscape was laid in 1991, when I was 15 years old, and my hometown's proximity to the state capital allowed me, along with several eighth-grade classmates, to work as an intern in a New York State Assemblyman's office on selected days of the week, an experience that didn't entail much more than licking stamps, stuffing envelopes, and occasionally fetching hot dogs from the carts outside the New York State Capitol for the Assemblyman's brother, but which forged a budding fascination with my country's political institutions. In due course, this fascination led me to other experiences. For example, an opportunity to shake the president's hand when Bill Clinton visited Albany during my senior year of high school, and led me to submit the winning entry in the 1994 New York State Democratic Committee essay contest. The proceeds from the contest helped pay for my first year at Harvard College, where my studies focused on political theory and political philosophy, and I was able to ruminate on current politics as a writer on the staff of the student-run Harvard Political Review. By the time I graduated in 1999, my undergraduate studies had transformed into a desire to study political theory in greater depth, and perhaps eventually teach it at the university level. I was especially interested in theories of international law, and decided to pursue this further by applying to both law schools and graduate programs in political science. In the end, I decided to remain at Harvard and work toward a PhD in the Department of Government. 2 years into the PhD program, after completing all the required coursework and tests, but before starting my dissertation, I made the decision to withdraw. Intellectually, my time in graduate school was fulfilling enough. It allowed me to take challenging graduate-level seminars taught by the discipline's best minds, including Stanley Hoffman and Samuel P. Huntington, two luminaries in the field who are no longer with us. But it took 2 years of graduate study to appreciate the fact that the academic discipline of political science is strangely separate from the actual practice of politics or functioning of government in the United States. With a few exceptions, there is typically very little interplay or discourse between professors of political science at American universities and politicians or other participants in the political process itself. Foreseeing that an academic career might be fulfilling only at an intellectual level, while neglecting other aspects of my underlying interest in politics, I turned to law school in search of more balance. The old adage, which was still widely believed at the time I attended law school from 2001 to 2004, is that one can do practically anything with a law degree. The experience promised 3 years of intense study of subjects relating to the American legal system, covering topics that would inevitably dovetail with my core interests in political theory, while culminating in a professional credential that, upon admittance to the relevant bar, would entitle me to be a practitioner within legal institutions that have served as the model for legal systems around the world for many years. I will have more to say about my time at Harvard Law School later on. For now, I will summarize by noting that I received my J.D. with honors, also served as an editor of the Harvard Law Review, and then began legal practice at Quinn Emanuel in Los Angeles, a large firm that specializes in litigating the interests of major corporations. I started work there as a summer associate during my second year of law school, and that is where I met my future wife Elizabeth, who was also a summer associate and studying law at Yale. We got married during our third year of law school, 7 months after our first meeting, and then both started work as full-time associates attorneys at Quinn Emanuel in the fall of 2004. It was only 3 years before we exited the world of corporate litigation. While the work was lucrative, it could also be soul-taxing. I was especially disenchanted with the work I was being asked to do as an associate attorney at the Miami office of a large international firm, on behalf of a company whose core business model was to make the foreclosure process less costly and more efficient for banks by circumventing property records requirements. The work pitted me directly against the interests of people who had lost their homes or on the brink of being foreclosed upon. Many of them could not even afford an attorney. The work did not leave me fulfilled and seemed like a misuse of my law degree. In June 2007, Elizabeth and I opened our own two-lawyer practice in a small windowless office across the street from the courthouse in downtown Miami. We started with a grand total of 2 clients, both of whom were pro bono and transferred to us from our prior employers. The first few months were memorably lean, but before long, our phone was ringing off the hook, as the initial years of Beck and Lee's existence coincided with a period of extraordinary demand for a certain type of litigation service in South Florida that not all lawyers were willing to consider, and we were able to provide. While the Great Recession is typically considered to have started in late 2007, South Florida was already feeling the effects of a slumping real estate market as of late 2006. Easy credit, coupled with the traditional lure of Florida property as an investment vehicle, had fueled a historic real estate boom beginning in 2005. The boom attracted numerous speculators who saw opportunities to profit off of rapidly escalating prices by flipping, that is, holding for a short term and then selling, real estate. By late 2006 and early 2007, many of these speculators, sensing the market was overheated and not based on a genuine demand for housing, had started to back away, leading to a substantial decline in prices. the resulting real estate market crash, which was already in progress by the time we opened our firm, led many to seek legal representation. After being in business for just a few months, our little law firm started to receive many calls and emails from a certain type of prospective client. Such people had signed a contract and paid a down payment or deposit to buy a condominium. At the time of the contract, which had typically been executed during the fevered 2004-6 real estate bubble time frame, the condominium was not even built. This is known in the industry as a pre-construction contract, where a portion of the buyer's deposit is used to finance the construction of the building. During the boom, many speculators had signed such contracts, hoping to flip them to someone else at a higher price. A single pre-construction condominium unit contract may have had multiple buyers in succession, each flipping to a subsequent one at increasingly higher prices, before the builders had even finished construction of the actual building. By flipping the contract, each buyer would realize a substantial profit, without even having had to take title to the condominium. But by mid-2007, with the market in decline, many of those who had entered into pre-construction contracts were starting to realize they were not going to find a new buyer to purchase the contract from them. Not only were they not going to make a profit as hoped, but they risked losing the entirety of their pre-construction deposit. And these deposits were not insubstantial. With many new South Florida condominiums priced at a minimum of $500,000 for even the more basic units, the deposit could run at least $100,000, and often much more than that. Buyers under pre-construction contracts were not only facing a substantial financial hit in the potential loss of their deposits. In some instances, the developers were threatening to sue them if they did not perform on the contract and close title to the condominium. But as the real estate market tumbled into freefall, it became virtually impossible to obtain mortgage financing to close on a condominium. The buyers were in a precarious legal position. They started seeking legal counsel. Almost everyone wanted a contingency arrangement, that is, no-win, no-fee basis, whereby the attorney would be paid for his or her legal services only if successful at recovering any monies. Due to existing loyalties to their developer, construction, or banking industry clients, many South Florida lawyers could not represent these buyers, while numerous others were simply unwilling to, due to the inherent risks for contingency work where the lawyer could not be sure he or she would receive payment. But as a new law office with few cases and no ties to the real estate, construction, or banking industries, Elizabeth and I had ample time, ability, and energy to take on many of these cases. We also had a small nest egg saved up from our few years of working at large law firms that allowed us to advance the legal costs of these lawsuits on behalf of our clients. In developing a specialized practice providing legal representation to buyers of pre-construction condominiums, we served hundreds of people caught up in the deleterious effects of an unregulated industry. It was a diverse group of clients, cutting across geographic and most socioeconomic boundaries. Wealthy investors from around the world bought pre-construction real estate, as did individuals of considerably more modest means. Among the many we assisted were police officers, teachers, small business owners, a postal worker, an entertainment promoter, lawyers, doctors, retirees, as well as an internationally renowned jockey. The income from these cases eventually enabled us to offer representation to clients in other underserved areas of legal practice, including personal injury, police misconduct, and class action litigation on behalf of plaintiffs. In most of these cases, the client pays nothing, not even covering the legal costs, which we would advance out of pocket. Such costs are a permanent loss for us if we do not recover funds for the client. By 2015, as Bernie Sanders was campaigning on the unfairness of America's rigged economy to packed venues across the country, Elizabeth and I had come to see the legal system as equally rigged in favor of corporations and the wealthy. Alongside its campaign finance jurisprudence, elevating the payment of money by corporations to privileged status among forms of political participation, the Supreme Court, in recent years, has issued opinion after opinion, making it increasingly difficult to hold corporations legally accountable. Nowhere is this trend more apparent than in class action law. Before and since the time Elizabeth and I switched from representing large corporations to bringing claims against them, the Supreme Court has made it ever increasingly difficult, and in many cases impossible, to make use of one of the most potent legal devices available for redressing injuries on a large scale. With its roots in the medieval English common law notion of group litigation, the modern American class action began to take shape in 1966. That year, the Advisory Committee on Civil Rules, a policymaking body charged with reviewing and recommending changes to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, revised the rule governing class actions to, among other things, allow for the possibility of aggregating the damages claims of numerous claimants or class members within a single lawsuit. The revisions were motivated by the desire to craft a receptive procedural vehicle for the many civil rights cases being filed in the wake of Brown v. Board of Education, as well as to facilitate the enforcement of public policy-driven laws in areas such as securities fraud and antitrust. By allowing for a single lawsuit to pursue the claims of many similarly situated class members through one or several class representatives, the new class action rule defined a powerful procedural mechanism for bringing corporations to account for their misconduct, especially when that misconduct caused separate injuries to many different individuals with little incentive to file a lawsuit singly. The reporter to the advisory committee, Benjamin Kaplan, defended the new rule as part of the class action's historic mission of taking care of the smaller guy. Accordingly, a corporation's total liability measuring into the multiple millions or even billions of dollars, but spread out over many small-dollar individual claims, might be adjudicated in a single proceeding. Before the modern class action, there was no practical way of determining such a liability. The efficacy of the modern class action procedure is well illustrated by the quickness of the backlash from corporate interests once the potential became apparent. In 1972, just 6 years after the advisory committee drafted the new rule, the corporate defense bar complained to the committee that class actions would lead to judgments of astronomical size and amounted to legalized blackmail and extraction of ransom. While, according to my old law professor, Arthur Miller, who participated in the process leading to the 1966 amendments, for the two decades following introduction of the new rule, class action litigation was allowed to flourish in a rather unencumbered way. By the 1990s, corporate interests had mobilized and were determined to dismantle it. As with campaign finance law, those interests accomplished their objectives largely through conservative judicial activism. Beginning with two decisions rejecting class-wide settlements of asbestos-related claims in recent years, the Supreme Court has handed down a body of case law piling up increasingly weighty stumbling blocks to the successful prosecution of class actions. This line of precedent has culminated in the wholesale eradication of the right to even file class actions for certain types of claims. Unsurprisingly, many of the anti-class action opinions have been signed by the same justices responsible for the court's campaign finance jurisprudence, placing corporate cash on the highest of pedestals. In 2011, within a span of just under 2 months, and 4 years into our transition from corporate litigators to plaintiffs' trial lawyers, the Supreme Court handed down two such opinions. Both dealt body blows to the continued viability of the class action procedure. Both were authored by Justice Scalia, who also joined the majority in Citizens United and McCutcheon, key campaign finance reform decisions which will be discussed further in Act Two. In Walmart Stores, Inc. v. Dukes, the court overturned an order granting class certification in a nationwide sex discrimination suit against Walmart. The plaintiffs presented evidence of significant pay and promotion differentials between male and female employees, as well as expert analysis demonstrating the existence of a corporate culture encouraging gender bias in employment decisions made throughout the company. This evidence was sufficient for both the trial court and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to find the case appropriate for class action status, so that the discrimination claims of some 1.5 million female Walmart employees could be decided in a single proceeding. In reversing the Ninth Circuit, the Supreme Court held that there was insufficient commonality for the class to be certified. The heart of the court's opinion comes in this striking sentence from Justice Scalia. In a company of Walmart's size and geographical scope, it is quite unbelievable that all managers would exercise their discretion in a common way without some common direction. For the court, speaking through Scalia, the existence of a common corporate culture shaping employee decision-making is unfathomable. In its view, there is only one way for a corporation to induce desired behavior in its employees, and that is via common direction. Power of suggestion, or just plain brainwashing for that matter, can apparently play no role. As will be discussed further when I trace the legal development of the American election system, while Citizens United famously greenlighted unlimited campaign spending by corporations in its refusal to see political corruption in anything other than quid pro quo arrangements, Walmart grants these same corporations a kind of blanket legal immunity with respect to the deleterious effects of any conduct that is not the result of explicit direction. In this fantasy world spun by the court, money never corrupts unless it is given directly for a favor, while corporations act only through express directives, never cultural or societal imperatives. Citizens United and Walmart are just two examples of the Supreme Court constructing the legal framework for a corporate oligarchy, based on a picture of human affairs which accords only with the reality that the oligarchs desire to create. AT&T Mobility LLC versus Concepcion, decided just 2 months before Walmart, followed this recipe to the letter, when it granted corporations a way of avoiding class actions altogether through the vehicle of class action bans and arbitration clauses in contracts. What Justice Scalia's opinion in Concepcion fails to advise us, of course, is that the now widespread use of arbitration clauses in contracts to preclude class actions was more than a decade in the making, and engineered by a Wall Street-led coalition of credit companies and retailers. One of those engineers who strategized from law offices on Park Avenue and in Washington on ways to shield companies from class actions was a corporate lawyer by the name of John G. Roberts, Jr., who went on to become Chief Justice and one of the majority in Concepcion, as well as Citizens United and McCutcheon. All of this seemingly relevant history is omitted from the opinion, where Justice Scalia repeatedly extols the virtues of private arbitration, noting arbitration's potential for streamlined proceedings and expeditious results. The problem, however, is that only a lunatic or a fanatic sues for $30. All the streamlined proceedings in the world are worthless to the small-dollar claimant without the ability to aggregate many small-dollar claims in a class action. A ban on class action litigation, like the one approved by the Supreme Court in Concepcion, is therefore nothing less than a ban on pursuing one's legal rights. As a result, in the wake of Concepcion, countless Americans, in cases ranging from consumer fraud, antitrust, employment discrimination on the basis of gender and race, and unfair business practices, have found themselves without a legal remedy against their banks, cable companies, credit card companies, phone companies, and employers. That is to say, the corporation's war on class actions, as implemented through their legal representatives, now including Chief Justice Roberts, worked to perfection. I recall reading Concepcion on my computer screen the day it was posted to the Supreme Court website, and marveling at how the opinion seemed so out of sync with the legal system I had studied in law school. The core premise is that a 1925 statute called the Federal Arbitration Act constitutes such a powerful embrace of enforcing private arbitration agreements, to the letter, so that this federal policy must take precedence over practically any other policy concern that could arise about these types of agreements. But in studying law at Harvard, the Vatican of legal scholarship and teaching about the American legal system, I hardly got any sense at all that arbitration was such a preeminent feature of our legal system. Our basic courses always taught us cases handed down by courts, not by arbitration panels. As far as I can recall, there was just one course offered on arbitration, which I took in my second year. International Commercial Arbitration, and it dealt with the framework governing the arbitration of complicated international disputes. Nothing close to the small-scale arbitrations that Concepcion conjures up as a means to do away with class actions. For such a supposedly critical feature of the American justice system and prominent matter of federal policy, arbitration was, curiously, barely discussed during my 3 years at one of the country's most prestigious law schools. And I don't remember a single question about arbitration appearing on the bar exam in either California or Florida. The truth, however, is that I, not the Concepcion Court, was the one who was out of sync with the realities of the American legal system. By virtue of what 9 years at Harvard, including 3 years at Harvard Law School, had failed to teach me. The Supreme Court's anti-class action jurisprudence is just one in a quiver of arrows shot through the heart of the plaintiff's bar by the dedicated legal representatives of the corporate oligarchy populating courthouses and statehouses. This line of cases has evolved as part and parcel of a wider judicial assault on access to justice, embodied in Supreme Court decisions enabling the use of summary judgment as a vehicle to prevent plaintiffs from having their claims decided by juries, alongside cases fabricating a heightened pleading standard in federal court that now routinely slams the courthouse door in the plaintiff's face before the case has even gotten off the ground. To quote my old professor, Arthur Miller, the question must be asked, is our American court system still one in which an aggrieved person, however unsophisticated and under-resourced he may be, can secure a meaningful day in court? I believe that for anyone who has tried to represent an unsophisticated and or under-resourced aggrieved person in the modern-day federal legal system, the answer to this question must be a resounding no. Having done so for the last 10 years, I've lost count of the number of times my client's meritorious lawsuit was thrown out before trial because the court granted a defendant's request for dismissal or summary judgment. The opinions issued by these courts are often baffling, from the vantage point of logic or legal reasoning, and the judges will frequently incorrectly cite or misapply cases to make it appear that the decisions are supported by legal precedent. The defendant is almost always a well-heeled corporation, represented by a team of many defense lawyers, often from more than one large law firm. The practice of law in these circumstances is terribly unsatisfying and unrewarding, because it entails the continual frustration of the very purpose of my role as a lawyer, to ensure my client obtains his or her day in court and has a fair, if inherently imperfect, chance at obtaining justice. If there is any solace, it is in the fact that the public record now contains at least one admission by a prominent judge of what plaintiff's lawyers have known for some time, that our legal system is decidedly rigged in favor of corporate interests. On March 28, 2017, the recently retired federal appellate judge Richard Posner, in a keynote address to attendees of an academic conference on antitrust issues at the University of Chicago, pronounced that the U.S. judicial system is very crappy, mediocre, and highly politicized. Judge Posner laid the blame for this state of affairs on the ownership of Congress by the rich, which he termed the real corruption. Observing that the allowance of unlimited campaign spending has made elected representatives slaves to the donors, Judge Posner explained that because federal judges are appointed by these same representatives, cases are decided by mediocre courts that are highly politicized, and that's what we have now in the Supreme Court, extremely reactionary Supreme Court justices appointed by Bush mainly. Judge Posner's striking observations regarding the legal system in which he held court for 36 years came as he articulated his view to a conference of antitrust scholars that antitrust, the body of law concerned with promoting and protecting competition in the marketplace, is now dead. Like the demise of antitrust, the death of class actions and access to justice, among other legal mechanisms meant to protect the smaller guy, can be traced to the political production of mediocre politicized courts. As far as I know, Judge Posner is the only federal jurist who has publicly acknowledged the reality of our present-day federal courts, and that they are the product of, and serve, oligarchic corporate interests. But Posner's words carry special weight. In addition to serving over three decades on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in Chicago, he was appointed by Reagan in 1981. Posner has written over 50 books and more than 500 articles, exercising an enormous impact on legal scholarship, particularly in the fields of antitrust and law and economics. The New York Times has called him the most dominant figure in American law in the past half century, noting his qualities of erratic genius, Herculean work ethic, and irrepressible ambition. In short, Richard Posner was the cream of the judicial crop. By late 2015, our experience working within the legal system so aptly described by Judge Posner led Elizabeth and me to become enthusiastic supporters of Bernie Sanders' campaign. While his platform did not directly address the gross bias in our courts, his blunt attacks on the campaign finance system wrought by the Supreme Court hit at the very root of the overwhelming inequity in the federal judicial system. Working to elect Sanders appeared to be the last viable avenue remaining to begin restoring fundamental fairness to our political system, and by extension, our legal system, where trying to represent the small guy, has turned into an increasingly frustrating and fruitless endeavor. 8 years of practicing law under the Obama administration had taught us not to expect any solutions from mainstream Democratic Party politicians. While Obama inherited the Great Recession from George W. Bush, his administration failed to make even a single arrest or prosecution of any senior Wall Street banker for the systemic fraud that precipitated the 2008 financial crisis. Many of our clients had been direct victims of this crisis, losing their retirement investments or even their homes as a consequence of criminal malfeasance in the banking industry. Aside from the fact that the Obama administration's inaction will ensure that another similar crisis happens again, it set the general tone for the continuation of a legal system which is rigged to guarantee that corporate interests will escape accountability time and again. While Citizens United was the product of, to quote Judge Posner, 5 extremely reactionary Supreme Court justices appointed by Republican presidents, Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Kennedy, Scalia, Alito, and Thomas, the Obama administration failed to prioritize the making of appointments to the federal bench, the one branch of government which has the power to neutralize the deleterious effects of Citizens United, that is, by overruling the case. To the contrary, Obama left office with over 100 judicial vacancies unfilled, nearly double what he inherited from his predecessor. Obama's failure on judicial appointments is perhaps best encapsulated by the fact that he is the only president in U.S. history who proved to be incapable of filling a vacancy on the Supreme Court. Obama's lack of appreciation for the serious problems inherent in our very crappy judicial system seemed characteristic of the Democratic Party's general attitude. For example, while the class action killing opinions, Concepcion and Walmart, were issued in 2011 by the same cabal of extremely reactionary justices responsible for Citizens United, unlike the latter, the class action killing opinions turned on issues of statutory interpretation, not constitutional law. Accordingly, and unlike Citizens United, the negative effects of these ill-conceived decisions may be reversed by acts of Congress. Nonetheless, congressional Democrats, who controlled both the House and Senate up until 2012, made only half-hearted efforts to pass such legislation, culminating in the proposed Arbitration Fairness Act of 2011. The bill, which would have made arbitration clauses unenforceable with respect to most types of class actions, never even made it out of the Senate Judiciary Committee for a full vote. Given the lackluster Democratic response to the judicial evisceration of individual rights vis-a-vis corporations, it was not hard to conclude that the mainstream wing of the Democratic Party is beholden to the same corporate interests motivating the Republican justices who stripped away these rights to begin with. Like many, Elizabeth and I initially supported Bernie Sanders by opening our wallets to his campaign. Before long, Elizabeth was spending much of her time volunteering, attending organizational meetings in Miami, including local Burnstorms, helping with crowd control at a rally featuring Sanders, as well as phone banking and text banking to reach voters. Our little law office became a phone banking outpost, with volunteers crammed around the conference table, sometimes making calls late into the evening. Bernie posters and other paraphernalia filled the walls. At some point, it began to feel to me that our efforts, which were almost entirely Elizabeth's, as she enthusiastically embraced the urgency of spreading Sanders' campaign platform to the public, were frustratingly inefficient. One person can reach only so many voters. That is why, indeed, that the spending of money on mass media messaging has become the very fulcrum of our electoral politics. The Magna Carta, setting forth corporations' powerful rights vis-a-vis the U.S. political system, Citizens United, arose in the context of a corporation's desire to produce a movie critical of Hillary Clinton and advertise it on TV during the 2008 Democratic primaries. Needless to say, it was not a case about phone banks. When the Supreme Court decided Citizens United, it went out of its way to rule that corporations cannot be stopped from making unlimited, independent expenditures on political campaigns. In removing any limitations on what it referred to as corporate speech, the Supreme Court laid the vital groundwork for what has become known as the Super PAC, political fundraising committees, which can raise unlimited amounts of cash from corporations, as well as unions, associations, and individuals, for independent expenditures on campaigns. Super PACs provided formidable support to Hillary Clinton's candidacy in 2016, with the largest, Priorities USA Action, taking in over $175 million and spending over $161 million to advance Clinton's candidacy. By contrast, the largest super PAC supporting Bernie Sanders, whose campaign repeatedly expressly attacked the very concept of super PACs, National Nurses United for Patient Protection, raised $8.1 million. Professor Miller has called the best plaintiffs' lawyers incredibly inventive, talented, and tenacious, some might call them stubborn people, who know how to find the back doors. Elizabeth and I have always strived for this ideal in our practice. When it came to helping Bernie, we felt there might be a back door within Citizens United itself. On February 22, 2016, Elizabeth and I became the directors of a new super PAC. The process of coming to control a vehicle that is permitted by law to inject unlimited amounts of money into U.S. elections was incredibly simple from a legal perspective. All we had to do was fill out a 5-page form titled Statement of Organization, FEC Form 1, on the Federal Election Commission website. We initially chose the name Do the Right Thing in reference to Spike Lee having recently come out in support of Sanders. Later we changed it to Jam PAC. The basic concept was this. Deploy the Super PAC not as a vehicle for funneling corporate dollars into mass media messaging for political campaigns favoring corporate interests, but as a network for collecting small dollar donations from individuals, like the average Sanders donation, and then using the funds to advance progressive campaigns. At the same time, we hoped to deploy new forms and modalities of communication, promoting norms of collaboration rather than manipulation. From a legal standpoint, at least, the concept had the advantage of being at least a practical response to Citizens United, rather than simply criticizing the decision as ill-reasoned and or ill-conceived and demanding it be overruled, highly unlikely anytime soon, or nullified via constitutional amendment, even more unlikely. We might at least try to harness some of the very potential unleashed by the Supreme Court's jurisprudence into a movement based, in large part, on reforming the campaign finance system. As I wrote about 8 weeks after starting Jam PAC, perhaps the system can be hacked, and the hack can make the system better. Right off the bat, however, The implementation of this vision of a hack had a hurdle to overcome. Without access to spigots of corporate cash like the super PAC supporting the Clinton campaign, we would have to find a way to have impact on the race on a very limited budget. While Elizabeth and I seeded JamPack with $20,000 of our own savings, that could only go so far, and time was short. This meant, for example, that while the major super PACs had ready access to legions of high-priced consultants to guide them on critical issues, our consultants were friends who graciously responded to our requests. After some quick telephone calls and brainstorming sessions, we settled on a strategy of producing and disseminating pro-Bernie Sanders messaging over the Internet, with the goal of launching one or more viral videos. At the time, various anti-Sanders narratives were emerging in the mainstream media, which we knew to be untrue, given our experiences on the ground in South Florida and through social media. Chief among these were notions that black voters don't feel the burn, and that Latinos had never been a core part of Bernie's constituency. Knowing how laughably absurd such statements were, in light of what we knew about the appeal of his campaign in our local and social media communities, we felt that they might easily be disproved through short videos that could be produced quickly, at low cost, and then disseminated through social media channels. Fortunately, we were able to persuade my old friend from college, Dan DeVivo, to serve as JamPack's creative director. Dan, an independent filmmaker who has produced and directed two award-winning documentaries on the immigration debate, put together JamPack's first video himself, and then connected us with a network of independent filmmakers who were more than happy to lend their considerable talents in aid of Sanders. The collective fruits of their labor can be viewed on JamPack's YouTube channel. Of the 8 pro-Sanders videos JamPack ended up producing, 5 featured Latino supporters and included what we believe to be the first Spanish-language videos promoting his campaign. The anemic number of views on JamPack's YouTube page bears testament to our failure to attain viral status on any of the videos. Most of the time, we worked to disseminate the videos through social media, including through paid Facebook boosts as permitted by our modest budget. Perhaps we didn't try hard enough, or perhaps the content of our videos wasn't viral-worthy, but at least one of our strategies was doomed to failure from the get-go. Our attempt to get the mainstream media's attention for what JamPack was trying to accomplish. For the same reason they were opposed to Sanders' candidacy, as will be discussed in detail in Act 1, the interests served by the mainstream media were opposed to the concept of drawing any attention to JamPack, its mission, or its implementation. Perhaps we were naive for even trying to attract its attention, or perhaps we overestimated our own ability to draw its interest, given that Elizabeth had had a well-publicized dispute with Donald Trump in late July 2015, arising out of one of our pieces of condominium deposit litigation. In any event, the mainstream media interest in what JamPack was doing was practically non-existent. Determined, we retained the services of a public relations specialist, Charles Jones, who had previously worked with us in our legal practice. A veteran local TV news reporter with many industry contacts, Charles wrote us an ominous memorandum on March 17, 2016. I have been glued to the national media coverage for the past month. The coverage is shifting far away from being balanced. This is what I see. 1. The media focus changes by the day. What's hot news one day could be completely ignored the next. 2. The media is transfixed on anything related to Donald Trump. I mean anything. 3. The media is transfixed on the implosion of the GOP. 4. The media is building up for the GOP convention in Cleveland. They want blood. 5. The media is already convinced Clinton will get the party nomination no matter what. 6. Every single campaign is complaining that their core campaign messages are not getting through via the national press. No one is covering real issues, just the daily Trump report about how he's winning or losing. 7. The media is completely ignoring all traditional ground and grassroots campaigns, unless it is an attempt to dismantle the Trump campaign. 8. The media does not care about debating the issues between Clinton and Sanders. 9. The media is completely ignoring the voice of millennials, minorities, women, etc. The folk